Computer. There we go. Okay. So welcome everyone to the Paystack Prep. This is geared more towards, I would say, the practical aspects of cashering and other Paystack cleaning things. Just a little bit of housekeeping. If you have any questions during the presentation, if you could post it in the chat, and I'll try to get to it either real time or at the end, depending on what the question is. Otherwise, if you could keep yourselves muted until the end, and then happy to go back and clarify things if you want to unmute yourself and you have questions. So I'm going to now share the screen for this presentation. We'll do a slideshow. Okay. So as you can see, cleaning for Pesach, I don't know if some of you have started or if you're going to get started or you're planning on starting next week. It's all up to you. But Pesach cleaning is a very intensive process, as you can see by this picture on the left, where it involves the whole family. Some people helping, some people hindering, some people just sort of being there. But there's also another mitzvah that has to do with Pesach, and that's in the other box, which is the Seder, which also involves the whole family. As you can see, both of them are mitzvos, but the emotions that they have on their faces are very different. There's a range of emotions cleaning for Pesach. Some people are excited, some people are unhappy, some people are oblivious. And it's important to remember that there is a mitzvah to clean for Pesach, and there's a mitzvah to celebrate Pesach Yom Tov, and there's a mitzvah of Simchas Yom Tov. There isn't a mitzvah of working yourself up into a tizzy cleaning for Pesach. And so it's important to keep that in mind, both for yourself as well as for others that may be helping you or potentially getting in your way. The other, I think, important thing to keep in mind to sort of balance that is that for thousands of years, there has been a tradition of going above and beyond what is required. There is a tradition of being more machmir when it comes to Pesach than when it comes to kashrus and other elements of mitzvah observance throughout the year. The rationale for that is that Pesach is the birth of the Jewish people. We're celebrating our creation as a nation. And just like when a baby is born, I guess, care and attention and level of quote unquote chumras that we have in terms of caring for the infant are much more heightened than somebody that has a more developed body, a more developed immune system. So too, when it comes to the Jewish people, when we are in our infancy stage, we need to be extra careful about all of the mitzvos that occur over the Yom Tov of Pesach. And what we try to do is to balance that idea of being mesameach, of being happy on Pesach, and being happy cleaning for Pesach and preparing for the Yom Tov, but at the same time also recognizing that there is a tradition of being machmir. And it's important to keep in mind something that Rabbi Willig often says, that every chumrah has a kula. Whenever you're being machmir in one thing, you end up being, by definition, more lenient in another. And so what we're going to try to do is to balance those two directives of both being machmir and as well as trying to maintain a simchas Yom Tov as well as a simcha of preparing for Yom Tov. One second, sorry here. Okay. So in terms of general kashering principles, we have this idea of kibolo kach polto. For some of you who can recognize this picture, that is from The Lord of the Rings. The two hobbits are marching to Mount Doom to destroy the One Ring, the evil One Ring. And so in the book, in The Lord of the Rings, this One Ring was forged in this volcano. And the only way to destroy it was to subject it to the same heat through which it was constructed. Same thing is true when it comes to kashering. We envision trefor, chametz, particles, or taste that is absorbed by utensils, by pots, pans, forks, knives, etc. And they're absorbed through certain heat and cooking methods. And so the way to purge that chametz taste or particles is by subjecting it to the same degree of heat and the same method through which it absorbed those particles. So in general, there are what we would say four different ways to kasher something. And we'll go in order. The first is libun. That is the most intensive method of kashering, and that is essentially scouring something with a fire or with a blowtorch or something until it is white hot. And unlike all the other three categories that we'll talk about, libun is different in two ways. The first is that you do not need to wait 24 hours before doing it. And the second is that technically speaking, you don't need to clean it beforehand because by definition, you're just burning everything. All the other ways or methods of kashering something need to wait 24 hours before actually kashering it. And in addition to that, you also need to pre-clean it ahead of time before those 24 hours begin. So libun is, as we said, is scouring something until it is white hot. Libun kal is essentially heating something to a temperature which modern day poskim believe is hot enough to burn paper. The next level down is hagala, which is immersing something in boiling water. And then the final method is irui, which is pouring boiling water on the utensil that you want to kasher. And so, as I said, those bottom three methods of kashering, libun kal, hagala, and irui, so all of those methods require you to pre-clean the object as best you can. And then after that, once that has been completed, you're supposed to not use that object with anything for 24 hours. Now we'll get into more details exactly what that means in a couple of minutes when we get to practical cases. But in general, we try not to use it with anything, meaning hot, cold, nothing. You shouldn't be using the sink, the oven, the fork, the spoon, bidyeved, if you end up using something that's very cold. So we're not going to restart the clock, bidyeved, but lechatchila, ideally, you should not be using it at all for the 24-hour period before you plan to kasher. So let's now go into the kitchen, and we'll go through some of the appliances. We'll start off with an oven. So in general, there are two different types of ovens. There's the self-cleaning and a standard one. So self-cleaning ovens reach a temperature of probably around 850 degrees or something like that. And so many poskim believe that self-cleaning ovens, if you put it on a self-cleaning cycle, has the status of libun gamor, of a full-fledged scouring. So if you have a self-cleaning oven, you can just run the cycle, and then you don't need to wait 24 hours. Technically speaking, you don't need to pre-clean the oven, but most people will tell you that it is advisable to do so. If you remove excess particles from the oven, you cause it to smoke less, it may damage it less, it won't smell as much, won't start as many fires. So we certainly do advise you to pre-clean it, even if you're doing the self-clean. Somebody told me last year that you should not use Easy Off. Apparently that's like flammable or something like that, or could damage it, so don't use that. But there are other methods that you can use to clean before doing it in a self-cleaning cycle. So now ovens typically have racks. So if you put the oven through a self-cleaning cycle with the racks inside, then you're good. You have kashered the racks as well. Some people don't like to do that because it could theoretically damage or stain or mess up the racks a little bit. My family's house, we've put them through the self-clean and it's been fine, but different ovens are different. And it's totally your prerogative. If you don't want to put the racks through the self-cleaning cycle, you can essentially treat the racks like a standard conventional oven, or meaning an oven that does not have a self-cleaning cycle. So when we talk about an oven that does not have a self-cleaning cycle, so then you have to do essentially Lieb und Kahl. You have to do the highest temperature that people typically use an oven at. I think most Poskim believe or measure it to be around 550. I guess theoretically, if you cook higher, you would have to do more than that. But most Poskim believe, and I think the standard is to do for is to have it at 550 degrees. The question is for how long? So there's different opinions. As you can, I don't know if you can see the notes, but I have I've talked to several post-skim people, kind of evaluate it between 35 and 40 minutes. If you have a tradition of having more or less, you can follow that. I would recommend 35 to 40 minutes. And so if you put the grate in the oven during that time at 550 degrees for 35 to 40 minutes, then theoretically you have also koshered those grates as well. Now there's also a convection oven. So for convection ovens, you would also have to need to use this Lieb und Kahl method, essentially putting it at its highest for 35 to 40 minutes. You would also need to have the convection fan blowing at the same time. So you need to have the fan in use during that 35 to 40 minutes so that it gets hot while it's blowing, and therefore all areas of the fan have been heated.
Rabbi, this is Sharon. I'm sorry, I'm having problems with my computer, but is 525, is that enough of a difference that it's not good because that's the highest my oven goes to?
Right. So again, like if your
Well,
oven
that's
only
anything on
goes
the main.
lower than if your oven only goes to a certain temperature, then that's as high as it can go. So that's totally fine. Meaning the rationale is that the highest temperature that you've ever cooked chametz with.
Got
So
it. Okay.
if your oven only goes up to 525, then that is totally fine. Now let's talk about the hood. So some ovens have a hood. Typically, or at least the ones I've seen, are made of metal. So that means that they absorb particles, or they absorb the taste of the chametz if you've ever cooked on a stovetop. So in terms of koshering the hood, if it's made of metal, you can kosher it by essentially, at the very least, throwing or spraying it with steam, essentially steaming it. We'll get into steamers, how they're kind of tricky because technically speaking, the steamer needs to make contact with the metal when it's actively boiling or at a boiling temperature. And so standard home steamers don't reach that. You have to have an industrial one. So in terms of a hood, I would recommend just covering it. I would recommend, cleaning it, waiting 24 hours, and then just covering it with tin foil. Obviously, the function of a hood is to allow for ventilation. And so there are ducts for airflow. So don't cover those up because that would be bad and that would defeat the whole purpose. Every other part of the hood, if it's metal or if it's a non-kosherable material, I would advise to just simply cover with tin foil. Now let's move on to the top of the oven itself, the range and the grates. So when it comes to the grates, you can basically put them in an oven if you have a self-cleaning oven. So that would be ideal. Once again, some people don't like to put the grates through a self-cleaning cycle. That's okay. Some people have new grates, which I would recommend if you're able to get. If you don't want to put them through a self-cleaning cycle, if that's logistically challenging or a financial struggle, the other way to do it would be to basically, after you've cleaned them and waited 24 hours and cleaned the entire surface of the range of the top of the oven, basically turn on the burners. You can do them one by one, but turn on the burners to its highest for I think people say around 20 minutes. And some people like place like an inverted bleph on top of the grates and the range to increase and condense the heat. Be careful, it gets hot. So that is another way you could do that. And then you'd essentially be just doing Liebman Kahl, koshering it as best as you can, which would also be fine. What's important to realize is that whenever you're koshering an oven range, you're only really koshering the parts that have fire. So an oven range has burners, but it also has areas that it may get hot, but they're not really getting the full brunt of the fire. So those areas are not koshered. It's important to realize that those areas are not koshered. So even if you have grates, if you have kosher for Pesach grates or you're koshered your grates, any area that's not covered by that, that's not covered by the grates themselves, should be covered in tin foil or some fireproof material, because that's not kosher for Pesach. Moving on to electric ranges, like an electric stovetop. So electric stovetops are also tricky to kosher from a koshering perspective. There are different opinions on how it can be koshered. You can't pour boiling water on it because it would ruin the stovetop. So what some people do, and this is what I would recommend, is basically once again turn on each burner until it glows. Certain ones glow, certain ones don't, but basically turn it on to its maximum. And then once it's reached its maximum heat, for again, like 10, 15 minutes, that area is kosher for Pesach. But once again, the rest of the area of the stovetop is not kosher for Pesach. So you would need to find some material. They make them, they sell them both in appliance stores. It's also, I think they also make like special kosher for Pesach covers. It's all the same. You just have to put on some fireproof or electric fireproof material to cover those areas that aren't koshered. Now we get to two instances where I would recommend doing Liebman Gamma. Liebman Gamma meaning with a blowtorch. Now I'll say this once, and I stand by it. Don't use a blowtorch in the kitchen. It is a terrible idea. And also, don't use a blowtorch even outside of the kitchen if you're not comfortable with it. Have someone else do it. The two times where I would recommend using a blowtorch to kosher something are for broilers and grills. So when we talk about a broiler in an oven, so you have the area where you broil things, and then you have the broiling pan or the removable surface where you put the food. So the drawer, or I guess the area in the oven that's the broiler, that can be koshered. The same way that you kosher a standard oven, basically put it to its highest temperature, and that's that. That doesn't work though for the broiling pan itself because the food is on that and it gets super hot. So what I would recommend is either get a special kosher for Pesach broiling pan or something like that, or if you want to kosher it, you would need to safely take it out of the house and use a blowtorch for that. If you're going to use a blowtorch, which again I'm not recommending, but if you're going to, what's important to realize beyond the safety concerns is that the metal has to get white hot in order for it to be koshered. So again, it gets really, really hot, and it can take a while if you're going through every part of the surface area. So I don't recommend it, but if you want to, that's what you would need to do. The other time you would theoretically be using a blowtorch is for a grill. Grills are also notoriously difficult to clean. You would need to just clean all the grates and clean out all the excess on the bottom, and then you would need to take a blowtorch and scour every part of the surface area of the grill, which again is potentially dangerous and time consuming. If you want to grill, I would recommend just getting a small, cheap grill for Pesach, like, you know, those they make small ones. if you would want a kasher, that's what you would need to do. In terms of warming drawers and toaster ovens, they're very difficult to kasher. I wouldn't recommend that. They don't get hot enough to really do any type of kashering. And so therefore many poskim are machmir. If that presents a very difficult scenario or Pesach for you, let me know. I can try to work. We can try to work together to come up with a way to kasher it, but I really would not recommend kashering a warming drawer or a toaster oven. Microwaves. So the last thing on this list is a microwave. So for microwaves, there are different opinions about how to kasher it, if you can kasher it. We follow the opinion that they can be kashered. If you have a glass tray in the microwave, especially for Ashkenazim, and even for Sephardim, it may be tempered glass. I would recommend taking out the glass tray, not using it for Pesach, or buying a special Pesach glass tray for the microwave if you need one. We are machmir not to kasher glass for Pesach, especially for Ashkenazim. In terms of the rest of the microwave, if you would want to kasher a microwave, you would need to do essentially Iruy, not pouring boiling water, but causing boiling water vapor to fill the microwave. The way you would do that is to once again clean the microwave, wait 24 hours, and then fill a container, microwave safe container with water, and bring it to a boil and have it long enough, have it boil long enough so that the entire microwave fills with steam. There are different opinions about it, and there are also different power levels for microwaves. So you should put it on the highest power, but microwaves operate differently. So you kind of just have to see how long it takes. Some people say an hour. I think that's very machmir. I think if you do it for 20 minutes, that should be more than enough. You may need less. But what's also just from a technical standpoint important to keep in mind, you can't microwave something for that long. Someone I know did that once and they ruined their microwave. What you would do is have it for, you would boil it for, I don't know, like 8 minutes or something like that. And then as soon as it's done, wait a second and then do it again for another 8 minutes. Or basically do it however long it takes until the entire area, interior of the microwave is filled with steam. Some people are machmir, once that has been completed, to basically move the container of water to a different part of the microwave so that the vapor can reach the area where that was initially covered by your container. If you're looking for a chumrah, I think that's a good chumrah to take on. It's not gonna kill anybody. It's not super time consuming. If you don't do that, I still think it's kosher. There are definitely opinions that you can rely on. But if you want to be machmir, it's not a bad chumrah to have. And there's certainly a rationale for it. I guess just more of a general thing when it comes to kashering. Any time where you need to pre-clean it, meaning if you're not using a blowtorch or a self-cleaning oven, I said that you not only have to wait 24 hours, but you also have to clean the surface. You have to cl basically clean the surface area of all of the kelim. So what does that mean to clean the surface area of a spoon or a fork or an oven, or a sink, as we'll get to? In general, the rule of thumb that I've been taught is that if you can rub your finger over a spot and you feel substance there, then you need to remove that. You need to clean it. If it's completely smooth, then it's just a stain. You don't need to kasher. You don't need to clean stains. You just need to clean actual mamashos, actual particles of food. If you're cleaning, very often oven grates can get stained, or microwaves can get stained. So you should certainly try to clean it as best you can. But after cleaning it, if you can just rub your finger over it and it's totally smooth, then it's just a stain and that does not need to be kosher. Now we move on to sinks. So, we can divide sinks into two categories, one of kasherable material, typically metal, and non-kasherable material, basically non-metal things. So when it comes to metal, so a metal sink like the one over here, the way that typically hot chametz will get into the metal of the sink is through either hot water or steam. So if that's the case, then you can do iru. You can pour boiling water onto all the metal surfaces. So how does that work? So once again, you would need to clean it, wait 24 hours. And then what I would recommend is to take a kettle. I think for efficiency's sake, it's better to have two kettles, but you can certainly just use one. Bring it to a boil and then pour that boiling water onto the entire surface area of the sink. Now, just a point that often comes up when you're kashering by pouring boiling water onto something. The only way that it works halachically is if when the water makes contact with whatever surface you're trying to kasher, it's actively boiling. So if you're kashering a sink, so every part of the sink needs to be exposed to boiling hot water. Now, the way kettles work is that it brings it up to basically just a boil, which means when you pour it out and when it makes contact with cold metal, and when it's no longer exposed to an operational heating element, it doesn't really last long, and you only get a couple of seconds, and you're just not going to be able to cover the entire surface area of the sink in one shot. So you're going to be doing multiple ones. Israeli kettles I've found last longer. The boiling or in the heat lasts longer because the Israelis are not as concerned about lawsuits, people getting hurt. From boiling kettles. But regardless, you're going to need to do multiple rounds of it. And also it's important to be careful. Wear heat resistant gloves. Please don't burn yourself. People do. I have in the past. It's dangerous, so be careful. Other parts that you would need to kasher, is the faucet, and that's where the hot water comes from. If the handle is nearby and could theoretically be exposed to hot chametz vapors and stuff like that, like in this picture. So you would need to kasher the handle as well. The soap thing, if you want to use that soap thing, you should kasher it, or you can just, turn it around and not use it for Pesach. If the faucet is extendable, so you would need to extend it fully and pour the boiling water onto the extension as well, assuming that that's metal, they typically are. And any area that you don't want to pour the boiling water on, or that you're not able to get the boiling water on, needs to be covered with some material. So I recommend heavy duty tin foil because it can tear if it's not heavy duty, and it also needs to be waterproof. So if you have heavy duty tin foil, that typically does the job. You could theoretically do something else. Also, if what you can see from this picture is that there's a non-metal lip in the sink. Some sinks have that, some things don't. But if you do have a non-metal or non-kosherable material lip in the sink, that needs to be covered. So again, you can cover it with tin foil, you can cover it with tape that's super sealed and waterproof and all that. But that's just something important to keep in mind. Another part of the sink is the drain slash strainer area. It's very difficult to kasher because of all the little holes that are exposed to chametz and stuff like that. I would recommend either getting Pesach ones or just not using them. You can buy rubber ones, you can buy metal ones. They're not terribly expensive. They're just very difficult to kasher. Again, if there's really some pressing need, let me know. We can talk about it, but I just don't recommend it just because it's logistically very challenging and not worth the time and effort. Some people are machmir to put inserts in a sink if they don't use an Eben Meluba. And Evan Maluban, we didn't speak about this before, but there's another way of kashering, which is in addition to the boiling water, you also put into the container a boiling hot or very, very hot rock. And that theoretically kashers something that had direct contact with hot food. So some people are concerned that there was hot chametz that made contact with the bottom of the sink when there was no other liquid there. And so in order to kasher it, then they would need this Evan Meluban. Or if they're not going to use a boiling hot rock, instead they would just buy an insert like in this sink for Pesach. Again, I don't recommend doing the hot rock thing. If you want to, that's fine. Just be very careful. If you want to be machmir and buy an insert, that's great. I don't think it's required. I think if you have a metal bottom of a sink, you can just pour boiling water and that's totally fine. Again, if you want to be machmir and buy an insert, you can. Everything that we've been talking about now, is if you have a kasherable metal sink. If you do not have a kasherable metal sink, then there's nothing you can do about that. You can't kosher it, so instead you would need to buy an insert or cover it with, again, heavy-duty tin foil and waterproof tape to seal it together. And we'll get to this next, you have to remember to kosher the surrounding countertop area. So with that, let's move on to countertops. So if you were on the halacha chat, you saw that there are different opinions about certain kasherable materials. So countertops are made with very different types of materials. Some are kasherable, some are not. In terms of kasherable ones, they include granite, marble, stainless steel, metal, and wood. So all of those can be kashered using Iru, using by pouring boiling water from a kettle. So once again, what you would do is you would clean the surface very well, and then you would wait 24 hours, and then pour boiling water on the entire surface area that you're planning on kashering. What that means is that once again, you're probably going to be doing multiple rounds of it, and having boiling water spraying all over a countertop could be very messy or dangerous. So what some people do is to simply just cover it once again with heavy duty tin foil or plastic. Like you can buy like plastic boards to cover large areas and reuse it from year to year. As I say on the bottom, foil is your friend. Plastic, all of that works. But if you want to kosher kasherable material, you would need to pour boiling water on every part of the surface area that you're planning on koshering. Non-kasherable material includes still stone, porcelain, enamel, corian, quartz, plastic. If you may have seen the halacha chat for mica is a debate where machmir and granite composite. So all of those cannot be kashered. So once again, you would need to clean it very well and then just simply cover it with tin foil or plastic or some other type of material. One second, I just want to check the chat. So someone mentioned a good idea that we handle utensils with pliers. That's a great idea. One that you can use. Yes, and you can use a metal utensil to pour boiling water on, and you can heat the metal utensil as you're kashering. That is true. Now let's get to other cleaning stuff. Utensils. So kasherable materials for other utensils are typically metal. So if you have something small enough that can be kashered using hagala of pouring it into boiling water, we're going to be doing that in the shul this coming Sunday. If you haven't booked a time slot yet, please feel free to do so. And we're also, by the way, looking for volunteers to help with the kashering. If you want to help out, we always appreciate volunteers. Anytime between 11 and 4, please let me know. In terms of materials that can be kashered, theoretically wood, most people don't have wood utensils, and especially ones that you can kasher dunking it into boiling water. So metals are often what people typically kasher. Glass, as I mentioned before, for Ashkenazim, we are machmir not to kasher. Rubber and plastic also cannot be kashered. This often comes up by infant stuff like baby bottles and cups or kiddie plastic forks and things like that. We'll get to that later. But all things being equal, plastic should not be kashered. Those metal utensils that you are planning on kashering needs to be thoroughly cleaned and not used for 24 hours. Same thing goes for the sinks and the countertops beforehand as well. So just practically speaking, oftentimes people will have to map this out in advance when they're kashering an oven, when they're kashering a kitchen, when they're kashering a countertop, when they're kashering a sink. So you need to map everything out beforehand and plan when is the last time you're going to use it before you kasher it for Pesach. If bidyeved, somebody accidentally hits the cold water knob on the sink and cold water pours out into the sink. Or you drop something, some cold hummus food on the countertop. So if it's really cold, excuse me, then bidyeved, you don't need to restart the clock again. If it's hot, so then it gets more complicated, reach out to me and we can talk about it. Next thing on the list are tablecloths. So tablecloths, if you're planning on using one made out of cloth or something like that, it needs to be koshered. The way tablecloths are koshered is by first cleaning it, waiting 24 hours, and then putting it in the washing machine with some detergent. I would again, this sometimes comes up if you have a more modern washing machine where they have these economy mode or environmental friendly mode with cold water. So Rav Moshe Feinstein is of the opinion that, and based on a Magen Avraham, that in order to kosher a tablecloth in a washing machine, you need to use hot water. If you're going to be washing a tablecloth for Pesach, make sure to use detergent and hot water. Refrigerators. So refrigerators obviously needs to be cleaned for Pesach. Everything needs to be wiped down and make sure there's no chametz particles. Some people are machmir to line the refrigerator. If that's your custom, great. If not, you do not need to. The rationale for doing so is because even though the prohibition of owning chametz is if it's bigger than a kezias, which hopefully you should be cleaning in the refrigerator, ingesting chametz is aser even with a mashu. It's forbidden even for just a little bit. And so we're concerned that maybe some crumbs that you missed may get stuck onto an apple or a container that you're holding in your hand, and then you put your hand to your mouth. So we are machmir about that. So if your custom is to line the fridge, great. If not, you don't need to, just to clean it very well. Also, make sure to clean every nook and cranny in the fridge, under the fridge. Even if you don't think there's chametz there, there is chametz there. You won't you want to you can't imagine how many times people have looked under their fridge and found Cheerios or breadcrumbs or anything like that. It just happens. Next thing is an urn. So some people want to kosher an urn for Pesach. The way you would kosher an urn is to basically bring water, fill it with water, and bring it to a boil, and then spill it out. And then once it's done that, once you've done that, now again, obviously, since you're not putting it to a blowtorch, you would once again need to clean it well, wait 24 hours. Some people like to boil vinegar in it to clean it. Apparently, that helps with the preserve the longevity of it and the taste of the water when you boil it. You don't need to do that for a kosher standpoint, but just if you want to take care of the urn, some people recommend doing that. Regardless, once it's been cleaned and you've waited 24 hours, and if you use vinegar, some vinegars are not kosher for Pesach, so keep that in mind. Once you've done that, then you would need to fill it with water, bring it to a boil. And then spill that water out. After that, though, you should do Iru. You should fill out the kettle and pour boiling water on the entire surface of the interior of the urn. And the reason is because when you have a large urn, the water might not be actively boiling. at every single part of the inside of the urn. And so in order to account for that, we pour boiling hot water from a kettle into all the places, into the entire surface area of the urn. The other part that you need to deal with, though, from a Pesach perspective, is the spigot, where the water comes out from. So if it's made out of metal, so you can do Iru, you can pour boiling water. Sometimes, though, those spigots are made out of plastic, which you cannot kasher. So you would need to cover all the surface areas as best as you can with tin foil or with some other type of material. Cars obviously need to be checked for chametz. They need to be vacuumed out. There is sometimes chametz gets into nooks and crannies, and you simply just can't get them out. The rule is, and this also comes into places where you don't need to check, if the chametz is inaccessible, then you're not obligated to remove it. Meaning, even if there's a huge loaf of bread and a building has collapsed on it, you don't need to excavate the donut or the loaf of bread or whatever the chametz is because it's simply inaccessible. So similarly, if a pretzel fell down into an area between the seats in the car and you simply just can't reach it, you don't need to do anything about it. Try as best you can, and if you can't, then you can't. Some people are machmir to like do something to spray it to make it inedible. That's up to you. Don't go crazy. If you can't access it, then that's totally fine. Work office. So anything that's yours in the office needs to be cleaned, and chametz needs to be removed. If you own a business, then theoretically you're responsible for all that chametz as well. If it's its own corporation, if it's its own distinct legal entity, then even if you're the primary shareholder, you may not be responsible for chametz that's not personally yours. That's beyond the scope of this year. If that's relevant, please feel free to reach out to me or Rabbi Zirkin. Happy to walk you through that. But assuming you're just an employee and you work in an office, so you need to remove all of your chametz beforehand. Places you don't need to check. So as I said before, chametz that is inaccessible, just physically inaccessible, does not need to be checked, does not need to be cleaned. And the other category of places that don't need to be checked are areas where you know you never brought chametz. Now, never means never, because if you brought it in once, it means you brought it in more than once. You brought it in twice, you brought it in three times. But if there's literally an area where you have never brought in chametz, then you don't need to check that. So some people just never bring chametz into a basement, into an attic, into a bedroom. So if you never have, then you don't need to check there. But assuming that you have once or twice during the year, so then you need to do a full bedikah. Just one more thing before we move on when it comes to refrigerators. Some people, especially if you have only one fridge and freezer and you're selling chametz in the fridge or freezer, will only sell part of a fridge or part of a freezer, like a shelf or a drawer. If you have the option of not doing that, certainly halachically it's okay. Practically, people can misplace things. People can put things on the wrong shelf. People can just act on instinct and take things from the wrong shelf. So it's challenging. If you're doing that, if that's the only way that you can do it, again, it's completely permitted. But you need to essentially cover it. So if you want to use tape, if you want to use some type of cardboard, whatever it is, you need to block off that area that you're selling to indicate A, that it's not yours, belongs to the non-Jew, as well as to indicate to you and to everybody else that it's not kosher for Pesach. So if you're going to be doing that, please remember, if you're going to be only selling part of a fridge or freezer, please remember to close that area off. Medicine on Pesach. So first and foremost, don't change anything about your medicinal routines without first consulting a physician. It's a bad idea. It's a bad idea to do so unilaterally. So please speak with a physician. before doing anything to change medications. In terms of how to analyze whether you can take certain medicine or not on Pesach. So there are three types of cholim. There are three types of people that are considered to be sick. So the most dangerous or the most at risk is a cholish shegesh basakana, somebody that is at risk of losing their life. And it doesn't mean they're at death's door right now, but it means that if proper treatment isn't taken, then they could very well be in a life-threatening situation. So, for example, diabetes. So if it's managed properly, then you can be totally fine. If you don't take the proper medication, you could very easily, chas v'shalom, deteriorate into a life and death scenario. So cholish shegesh basakana is the most dangerous. The opposite end of the spectrum is what is known as mechush ba'alma, where you just feel uncomfortable. And then in between is what is called a cholish she'ein bo sakana, somebody that is unwell, but they're at no risk of their life. So that's obviously a very broad range. And most poskim define it as either you're so debilitated that you're bedridden, or even if you're not physically bedridden, you're so incapacitated that you can't function normal. So those are the three categories. Most strict is somebody that is at risk of losing their life. Middle category is somebody that is so debilitated they're either bedridden or they can't function normally. And then the third is just mechush ba'alma, where you feel uncomfortable. So obviously, when it comes to the most strict of a cholish shegesh bo sakana, so you're allowed to eat anything you want. So you can certainly have chametz on Pesach if it's a cholish shegesh bo sakana. Mechush ba'alma, if you just feel uncomfortable, so then unfortunately you have to tough it out. You can't. You can only eat things that are kosher for Pesach. Cholish she'ein bo sakana is where things get a little bit more nuanced. Somebody that is healthy in a sense that they're not at death's door, but they are so debilitated that they are either bedridden or can't function normally. So then, for Ashkenazim and obviously for Sfaradim, you are allowed to have, you are allowed to eat kitnios. And that is a game changer when it comes to medicines. Most medicine, and I guess we can kind of break down medicine into three categories. You have simple swallowable pills. Then you have chewables or more complex solids like coated things or gummies. And then you have liquids. Those are, I would say, the three categories. So when it comes to just simple pills that you swallow that aren't coated, that aren't in capsules, most posts can say that that's not called food. The expression in halachas are just like rocks. And so you don't really need to be concerned about any chametz or any kidneys. So obviously it's better if you can check beforehand, but it's not necessary. You can take you can take just simple swallowable pills. You don't need to be concerned about chametz, certainly. And even kidneys, to be honest, you don't really need to be concerned about it. If you have the opportunity to check, then you should, then it's better to check. But most of them don't contain kidneys as well. It gets more complicated when it comes to more complex solids like capsules or coated or chewables. So those may have, or at least part of it, may have the status of food. And the same thing goes for liquid. We're much more machmir about the status of liquid than we are for solids. So even if it's pure medicine, oftentimes liquid has the status of food, and especially flavored liquids may contain kidneys. Again, they could theoretically contain chametz, but more often than not, they contain kidneys. And the same thing is certainly true for chewables or gummies or coated pills as well. So if you need to take either a liquid or a more complex solid, like something coated or chewable or a gummy. So that all things being obviously, if you're a cholish sakana, you can eat whatever you need, you can take whatever you need. But even and if you're a cholish sakana, so theoretically you can have kidneys. So most medicine is probably okay if you are a cholish sakana in terms of kidneys. Because even if it has kidneys, it's okay. That being said, if you have the ability to check beforehand, I would still look because some medicines may actually contain chametz. And if you're a cholish shein basakana, you can't have that. If you're not able to, if you're not able to check, And you just need to make a game time decision. So if you're a Holotrain bus Akona, it's probably okay, especially if it's like a liquid or something like that. But it is better to check. It genuinely is better to check if you can. And then the lowest category, if you just feel uncomfortable, but you're not so debilitated that you're bedridden or you can't function, it's just uncomfortable. So then you can't even have kitnios if you're Ashkenazi. So then you really do need to check if you're ingesting something that's more than a simple swallowable pill. So there are lists. The OU has a list. The Star K has a list. So please look online and try to do some research ahead of time. You can also, if you're not able to find it, you feel free to reach out to me. I can try to answer as soon as I can. Then I guess the last category, which I wouldn't call medicines, but are medicine related, are vitamins, like dietary supplements, or a prenatal vitamins or something like that. So all things being equal, assuming that you're a healthy person and you're just taking it proactively or to make yourself even more healthy, so that's not called medicine. And so it needs to be kosher for Pesach. It can't even have kitnios if you're Ashkenazi. If there is some reason why the doctor is saying, okay, you need to take this vitamin, you need to take the supplement, so please feel free to reach out to me or Rabbi Zirkin. We're happy to talk it out, or try to find you a kosher for Pesach version of that. There are many medicines and vitamins that do have a kosher for Pesach alternative. They're made by from companies. You can look online. There are a couple of brands that sell them either on their own website or on Amazon that are advertised as kosher for Pesach, kitnios free, different vitamins, different supplements, and all that. So especially when it comes to supplements, but honestly, even when it comes to regular medicine, if you're a cholish ein bo sakana, then if you have the option of having a kosher for Pesach version rather than having a kitnios version, you should try to have the kosher for Pesach version. As I said before, just to sort of sum up on the medicine area, if you have the opportunity to check beforehand, before buying or taking some medicine, it's obviously better. If you can't, if you're for whatever reason you're not able to check or you can't find out, so obviously if you're a cholish yesh bo sakana, you can do whatever you need. If you're a cholish ein bo sakana, you can certainly take a swallowable simple pill. Anything more than that, it probably doesn't have chametz. It may just have kitnios. So if you're cholish ein bo sakana, that's okay. If you have the option to check, then you should. And if it's meichush ba'alma, if you just feel uncomfortable, so once again, you can usually take just regular, simple, ingestible, swallowable pill. But if you need something more complex, like a coated or chewable, and it's just a meichush ba'alma, you re or just like a vitamin, like a proactive vitamin or dietary supplement, you really should be finding a kosher for Pesach version. But once again, I do need to reiterate that if you are taking medication, please do not do anything without first consulting your doctor. Moving on to the next section, which is related, infants. So infants, in general, both when it comes to Hilchos Shabbos, but also when it comes to Hilchos Pesach, have the status of a cholish ein bo sakana. It doesn't mean that they're just perpetually sick, even though some of you might feel that way when they come home from playgroup with a cold or a fever. Infants, are very limited, in what they can eat, or what they're able to eat, or what they want to eat. So we typically give them the status of a cholish ein bo sakana, which means they can eat kitnios. So let's just go through where that comes up often. So first of all, if you have the option of having a non-kitnios version, that's obviously better. So let's take formula, for example. So some formula has no kitnios and some does. So if you have the option of using kitnios-free kosher for Pesach formula, the OU has a list, that would be ideal. At the same time, babies are very temperamental in terms of which formulas work, which ones don't, which one they like, which ones they don't. And so definitely don't change at the last second. Try experimenting beforehand, see if it works. If it doesn't work or you don't have time to try beforehand, then using a Kitneos version is totally fine. Shouldn't be chametz, most aren't, but you should check beforehand which ones are okay. Now let's get to, and then also when it comes to other food, like cereal or any other type of food, baby food. So they obviously can't have chametz unless it's life or death, or they need that particular nutrient that they can only get from chametz. But if there are alternatives, then they certainly shouldn't be having chametz. Also, if there are alternatives, they shouldn't be having kitneos either. Meaning, if they're able to just have regular food, you should try that. But once again, don't change at the last second. If they, if it's not going to work or they really need kitneos, then it's totally fine. Now let's get to the non-food part. Bottles, feeding equipment. So as I said before, we don't kosher glass. If you're Ashkenazi, and we don't kosher plastic. That's and we don't kosher rubber. So that's pretty much the three materials that baby utensils are made out of. So if they can use regular ones, great. Use kosher for Pesach regular ones. If you're able to buy a kosher for Pesach set, that would also be ideal. But that can get expensive. That can get logistically complicated. So if for whatever reason that's not possible, so then especially if it's just kitneos, then they can certainly use their regular things. They should be cleaned thoroughly. They should be washed thoroughly. They should you should wait 24 hours before using them for Pesach. But then theoretically, you can use the regular equipment, the regular bottles, the regular utensils, and all that. If you're going that route and you're using the ones that you use throughout the year, what we typically recommend is that you do the washing or cleaning them in a different sink than the ones that you use for all your regular kosher for Pesach kitchen stuff. So oftentimes, what we would recommend is like washing them or cleaning them in the bathroom sink, because we don't want any potential kitneos food particles getting into the sink or getting into any other parts of our Pesach kitchen. Again, if you can't do that, let me know. We can try to brainstorm a way to minimize the exposure to kitneos for everybody else in the family. High chairs. So high chairs should be cleaned and should be searched thoroughly. There's always a pocket or some inner fold where there's chametz. Babies are very creative. So you should clean and check it thoroughly. What we recommend is that the area, the surface where, excuse me, like the tray or wherever the baby eats from, that should be lined with something, obviously something that's safe. Toys. So also toys are just a repository for chametz. They should be cleaned and searched thoroughly. If you're not going to be using certain toys for Pesach, you could just sell them and just have them in a different area. But if you are using, if you are planning on using toys for an infant, or toys for an adult, that sometimes gets food on things, they need to be thoroughly cleaned and checked. Travel. So when it comes to bedikas chametz, people ask me, when do I do a bedika? So in general, if you're leaving between now and Pesach, you do need to do a bedika in wherever you live right now. So if you're leaving 2 days before Pesach, so you need to do a bedika, preferably at night, preferably with a flashlight. You don't need to do the bedika at night, but we do recommend it. Regardless, you do not make a bracha. You only make a bracha if you do it on the night when we typically do bedikas chametz, i.e. the night before Pesach. If you're leaving beforehand, you still need to do a bedika. You just do not do it with you just don't do it with the bracha. If you're going to a place for Pesach, oftentimes you're going, if you're going to family, so then presumably they did a bedika. If you're going to a hotel, if it's a Jewish hotel, so oftentimes, or if it's being run by a program, so oftentimes they've done a bedika anyway. If for some reason you are renting like an Airbnb from a non-Jew and you get there after and you get there on Erev Pesach, so then you do need to do a bedikah for whatever areas will be yours for Yom Tov, and you should do it as best as you can. You should do a bedikah. Again, that doesn't often come up because if you are, if you really did like rent a house, then presumably you came beforehand before the night of Bedikas Chametz or the night of Bedikas Chametz at the very least. So you'll be doing a Bedika regardless there. If you get to like an Airbnb on Erev Pesach, and it was a non-Jew who didn't do Bedikas Chametz the night before, then you should do it probably without a bracha. But you should do a bedikah on the areas that are yours for the duration of Yom Tov. Mechiras Chametz, so the forms are live. Better to do it in person. If you can't do it in person with me or Rabbi Zirkind, you can do it online. There are two different forms. One are what we call domestic, and one we call Israel or international. Basically, if you're going anywhere in the United States, you fill out one of the regular forms or the domestic forms. If you're going abroad, especially if you're going east, so to Israel or anywhere else east that's in a different time zone, before Riverdale, you need to fill out the international Israel form, where the mechira is triggered the day before or the night beforehand. That way, just because of time zone differences, we want to make sure that all of your property is sold by the time Pesach comes. Another thing is Maoschitim. There's a long-standing custom for thousands of years to give tzedakah before Pesach. You can do that to the Chesed Fund in the Shul. Because it is only a custom, you can use Meiser money. Finally, post-Pesach. If you sold your Chametz, hopefully we'll buy it back. Hopefully the person we sell it to will be interested in selling it back to us, assuming that he does. You can certainly use it on Matzei Yom Tov, but you do need to wait. You do need to wait a certain amount of time to allow the transaction to go through in order to buy back the chametz. So that's typically an hour after Pesach is over. We'll have more information as that comes. And then also, when it comes to buying products after Pesach, so if it is a store that was owned by a Jew that wasn't keeping mitzvot and had chametz that they didn't sell. So then that is considered to be Chamech Avar Alav HaPesach. That's not allowed. And after Pesach, the RJC will release a list of local vendors that are permissible to buy. Obviously, any Jewish ones that are under the VAD of Riverdale are okay to buy. We've sold them to a non-Jew for Pesach, but even ones that aren't under the VAD, like ShopRites and stuff like that, will have a list of vendors where there's no concern of Chametz Avar Alav HaPesach. Last thing, on this slide are some links. I'll send out Bli Neder the slides afterwards for people to look at, as well as the recording. These are links to resources that you can use if you have questions about kashering or questions about food products. So the RJC Pesach site. The second is the OU Pesach guide. The third is the Star K Pesach guide. All of those resources are phenomenal. There are others as well. The second thing on this slide is items that don't require a hechsher. This is from the OU magazine, so you can look it up. Just many people ask me about this stuff, so I have it right here. I'm not going to read all of them, but many of these do not need a hechsher. You can just buy them and use them. I'll highlight some things. Plastic utensils, like disposable plastic plates and forks and all that stuff, that does not need a hechsher. You can just simply use it. Shampoo, in general, like toiletries, hand soaps. If it's not like super duper fancy schmancy fancy, hand soap, it's totally fine. Some people are machmir about lipsticks and toothpaste because it goes in your mouth. It is a machlokas. The custom of our community is to be makel, is to be lenient. Any toothpaste that is, commercially sold, any commercial lipstick, assuming that it doesn't have like pieces of bread in it, is totally fine. Some people are machmir to get a different actual I guess, stick of lipstick or chapstick because, they're concerned maybe there are some plumate particles on it from that accrued throughout the year. That's a chumrah. I don't think it's a crazy chumrah to have. And certainly when it comes to toothbrushes, you should definitely get a new one for Pesach. There's some chametz stuck somewhere on it, even if you clean your toothbrush very well. Okay, and then just to finally close out, there's a common phrase that we often wish each other to have a chag kosher v'sameach, to have a kosher yom tov and a happy yom tov. I said this last year, I'll say it again. There's a story where a young boy went on Pesach night after shul to wish Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky a good yom tov, so he wished him a chag kosher v'sameach. And Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky stopped him, and he said that up until Pesach, we wish people a chag kosher v'sameach, that they should have a kosher and happy Yom Tov. Once Pesach starts, he says, we assume that every Jew is kosher, and we just wish them a chag sameach. We just wish them a happy Yom Tov. And I think that that should be our perspective going into Yom Tov, that we should endeavor to have as kosher Pesach as we can. And as I said before, there is a tradition of being more machmir when it comes to preparing for Pesach than we are throughout the year. But at the same time, to never lose sight, and especially with the onset of Yom Tov, to make sure we maximize our simcha of Yom Tov and simcha of preparing for Yom Tov, as well as other people's simchas, preparing and experiencing Yom Tov as well. That's it on my end. Thank you all for coming. If anyone has any questions now, please feel free to use the chat or to unmute yourself. Okay. Thank you very much. And Bli Nedar, I will post the recording and the slides as well. If anybody has any questions, please feel free to email. Please feel free to use the Halacha chat. It's going to get busy, so can't promise I'll answer everything instantaneously. But thank you all for coming tonight. Have a wonderful evening and a Chag Kosher v'Sameach.
Thank you very much, Rabbi. Thank you. It was wonderful.